Dear listeners, this podcast is created by Linguistov team. If you want to practice and improve your English in a fun and creative way, please visit our website www.linguistov.ru. And if you want to share your opinion and ideas regarding our discussions, you can email us at info@linguistov.ru.
Sidmid. Sidmid is a visual futurist and concept artist. He is best known for his designs for science fiction films, such as Blade Runner, Aliens, and Tron. Of his work, Mid once moved to comment, "I've called science fiction reality ahead of schedule." Mid was born in St. Paul, Minnesota on the 18th of July, 1933. He graduated from high school in Colorado Springs, Colorado, in 1951. After serving a 3-year enlistment in the U.S. Army, Sidmid continued on to the Art Center School in Los Angeles, where he graduated in June 1959. He was recruited by the Ford Motor Company's Advanced Styling Studio. Mid left the studio after 2 years to accept a variety of assignments to illustrate books and catalogs for large corporate entities such as United States Steel. In 1970, he launched Sidmid Incorporated. Sidmid lives and works in Pasadena, California, and he kindly agreed to give this interview to Asia.
Asia?
Hi, Mr. Sid.
I am in my atelier.
Actually, I would like to say that this is a great honor for me to talk to you.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
You are a living legend amongst designers, and while I was preparing for this interview, I discovered that you are much more popular in Russia than I imagined.
Years ago, I had a young lady who was delivering, there was an artist, I think, in... It wasn't in Moscow. It might have been she was delivering sketches as a gift to me from a young artist friend of hers. I guess she was his date or something.
Mm-hmm.
And that was so unusual. We've gotten fan mail from Bulgaria and Yugoslavia, not Yugoslavia, that's old. Some of the countries bordering Russia. Yeah, it's very surprising to me.
Yeah, I was searching the web and I was actually surprised to find a lot of websites and groups and social networks where people show admiration for your work and they actively discuss your art and style.
Wonderful.
Yeah, so you have a lot of fans in Russia, I'm sure.
Because in the old days, you know, the futurists were a group of artists in Russia.
Yeah.
I mean, so, generations ago, but they called themselves the futurists.
Yeah, so this is really great. So let me start with my questions.
Okay.
So after the army, you entered the Art Center School. Why did you choose this school, and were there any doubts, maybe some alternatives regarding the choice of the future job?
Well, at the time, I was in the army in Okinawa during the Korean War, and I sent some card drawings to the head of styling at Ford Motor Company, John Reinhardt.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote back a very nice letter, and he said, "I like your design ideas." He said, "If you'd like to go into this as a profession, I would suggest the Art Center School in Los Angeles." So when I got out of the Army, I flew down to Los Angeles and interviewed and got accepted within 15, 20 minutes after they saw my portfolio.
So you didn't even have to pass the entry exams?
No. And then I flew back to Colorado, where I had spent the last 10 years of my life before the Army. And then came back to school that September, from June to September. So I started right away, went straight through in 8 semesters, and then worked for Ford for a short period of time and then left.
Mm-hmm. And how did you come to this kind of style? A lot of Russian fans are curious about that.
Well, I started drawing when I was 3. I'm now writing my autobiography.
Mm-hmm.
And I have drawings from the time I was 3. Because my father got his master's degree in fine art, and his thesis was creativity in young children. So I was his guinea pig. He saved everything. And most people don't have that luxury of having artwork like that from their early years. So,
What were your first drawings? Like future cars or?
No, they were faces.
Faces.
Because young children identify with faces immediately. You know, children to their mothers and their immediate family.
So how did you move from faces to cars and to future?
Well, I guess I just observed the world around me when I was six. I drew a car carrier, a tractor in front and a long thing in the back with cars on top. So I guess I must have seen one going by, and it was so fantastic that I drew a picture of it, my own version.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time I was 10 or 11, I could draw essentially still lifes and portraits of my family members.
But you still preferred to draw some cars and some...
I've always been fascinated with cars. One of the only incidents involving Russian cars that, you know the name, the Moskvich.
Yeah, sure.
Well, I worked with Raymond Loewy's studio in Paris, redesigning the Moskvich, which was sort of a bad copy of the Italian Fiat.
Right, yes.
And so we were going to, I designed the interiors. And then that was during the Khrushchev era, and the contract ended very abruptly with a telex. But that's the only Russian connection to design. So that was a long time ago too.
So you have no, you have never heard of such Russian cars as Marussia B2. This is the luxurious sports car.
Yes, yes. Now you sent me a picture, I think, of two front ends. Did you?
No,
somebody
that,
did.
That was not me.
And okay, somebody did, and I commented. It was a sports car, Russian sports car design, and I commented on the reason I liked one more than the other because it was more graphically connected or consistent.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I see. So after graduating the Art Center School, you started working in the Ford Advanced Styling Studio. Two years later, you left Ford. Why?
I got a very good offer. It's really sort of complicated, but when you come into a new company, as a new employee,
mm-hmm.
they put your artwork up on the wall of the studio to sort of say, welcome to the new guy, and here's what he does. And so,
mm-hmm.
so one of the people there saw my artwork. By that time, Mr. Reinhardt had left Ford as chief stylist to go to work for United States Steel as an automotive marketing executive.
Mm-hmm.
And... So I was contacted by, very surreptitiously, it was like a secret meeting down in the locker room, and he said, Mr. Reinhardt would like to meet you. And I said, well, that's wonderful, because then I can thank him, you know, for starting my career.
Uh-huh.
So we had a meeting, the company in Chicago that published the book for United States Steel and the other ones that I designed, hired me from Ford. At that time, this is 1950 or 1960. The salary for a professional designer was $5,000 a year, but that also was the price of a new Cadillac. That's how bad the U.S. dollar has gone downhill since then.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had lunch with the people from Chicago, and they raised my salary to $25,000 a year over lunch.
Oh.
And I was suddenly a very, very lucky young man.
Uh-huh.
So I stayed. Yes, I stayed. I had a lot of money. I had big parties, and I bought a big house. I had a Mercedes Papillon, you know, the Gullwing coupe.
So how did you feel suddenly becoming a rich
well,
person?
Well, I felt compared to my fellow graduate students, I knew that I was very, very lucky, and that I had more money than they did, and that's why I had parties for 200 people.
That's great. Right. So after that, you have never worked on designing real cars. I mean, except the ones for the science fiction movies.
No. The at Ford, I designed, helped design body shells for future for auto show vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. And the only real vehicle I designed after I left Ford as a consultant was a show car. A pickup truck kind of looking thing with a movable cab and so forth. That was done on commission, and I got paid, of course, a lot more than I would have as an employee of Ford.
Why didn't you design for car companies?
Well, because car companies are very insular. They like their own people. They don't like to hire outside people.
But you had your reputation.
Yes, I did, but that
and the transportation design is your first love, so
it doesn't matter. They might do a special edition of a car, like Lincoln had Bill Blass do a special edition and so forth. Gucci, I think, did a special edition, was it for Cadillac or some U.S.? Anyway, but then I started designing cars theoretically to entertain and visually capture the attention of people in the car industry by this series of books that I did for United States Steel. And that launched my reputation worldwide, because a lot of these books, they were free from the United States Steel. They were elaborate books, maybe 110 pages, something like that, full color. And these went worldwide because a lot of the Peace Corps guys at that time from college had some of these books. I got a designer from Burroughs Corporation, which I think is now bankrupt, but in Detroit. He had seen my work in Borneo. Now, how far away is that?
Wow.
And he said, I want to be a designer just like whoever did this book. And so he went to Art Center also and became chief designer at Burroughs. So that's how the connections work, you know.
Yeah. So the minivan, my next question, the minivan Pontiac Transport reminds me of your work. What do you think of its design?
Well, the minivan, the Transport, that was Chrysler's, the Caravan. That was a brilliant marketing thing, because at about that time, the station wagon, which, of course, now has been reborn as the Ford Flex, the station wagon was sort of, you know, considered a dull, boring kind of a thing that big families had.
Right.
And you went to grandma's farm in the back of the station wagon. And the Caravan was a brilliant use of an existing chassis, and it satisfied the needs of the habit of families having their kids, driving them to soccer practice or to school functions. And it was an instant hit. It really did a lot for Chrysler's profit.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So if you had the possibility to change the direction of the development of the transportation design, what kind of change would it be and why?
Well, you have to take into account the fact that right now, just over half of the world's population lives in cities. So, and a lot of the cities are
overcrowded. Maybe there shouldn't be any cars in the cities.
Well, no, that's not the point. The point is that they're too big to walk from edge to edge, okay? And you need somehow to get there. If you're in a car and your car is taking up, I'm trying to think in meters now, maybe a meter and a half wide and 3 meters long, then you get a whole bunch of these and you're covering so much ground for one person or two people. So what you need is a capsule kind of affair, and that's becoming more noticeable at auto shows all around the world.
More compact.
One or two person, essentially a moving little cabinet, because you don't have to go very fast. You know, we're not going to go 100 miles an hour. We're going to go maybe 15, 20, 30 miles an hour, and that'll get you across the city very efficiently if there's not too many other big cars in the way. So transportation in big cities will become more and more a public access kind of a thing. It's not quite transportation socialism, but it's efficient use of existing resource.
But does it mean that each family will have two vehicles, the one for city, like you said, some kind of a capsule, and the one for off-road driving?
Well, yes, and the other one that is not the city car, you would lease that because it's going to sit vacant most of the time. We have four cars right here. We have a daily driver, which is a Cadillac. We have a little convertible, which is a Chrysler Sebring. And then we have two collector cars, which are back from the era of the 50s and the 70s. And these are 2.5 ton, you know, 18, 19 foot long. It's almost 6 meters. They're huge cars. So we don't drive those every day, obviously. But they're fun to drive because they're so different. They're huge. And it's a completely different sensation when you drive these, as opposed to being even in a modern car with the hood sloping down. You can't see your hood anymore. It goes away from the windshield. So I think in the future you'll always have a mix of vehicles. I mean, think right now. The gasoline around the world is getting more expensive.
Yeah.
And you have the Bugatti, which is 1,100 horsepower. You have the Cadillac CTS-V, which is 556 horsepower. I've driven that car, and it's amazing. The Corvette has 500 and some horsepower, and a lot of your European supercars are easily 500 horsepower or more.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these are special-use cars, and in this country, gasoline is about $4 a gallon, which is cheap by European standards.
Mm-hmm.
And so people can afford to have a car that only gets 14 miles to the gallon as their first car because they don't have to drive very often.
You know? Right.
It's a special use situation. And in large architectural complexes, now I don't know to what extent in the cities in Russia like Moscow and Leningrad and so forth.
Well, Moscow is a crazy one.
You have large architectural enclosed like shopping malls and things.
Right.
And you have escalators and you have speedwalks in airports.
Mm-hmm.
I think in large cities you'll see more and more of these in enclosed spaces that are essentially transportation. Mm-hmm. An elevator is transportation, a vertical transportation idea.
So talking about the cities of the future, Moscow is a very huge city and the transportation collapse is about to happen because there are too many cars, each family having at least two cars.
Yeah.
And right now the government of Moscow is thinking how to change the situation. Maybe they should somehow close the center of the city so that no cars can be allowed in the center. Or maybe they are trying to relocate the offices somewhere in the suburbs. So there are different ideas. So how to free the city from this amounts of cars? Is it possible or the capsule is the only solution?
Well, the problem is to get people from A to B, from where they live to where they work. Now, in the old days when the Industrial Revolution first happened, you needed a lot of workers for the factories. And they usually lived right around the factory, which is sort of the early industrial era model.
Mm-hmm.
Because they walked to work. They didn't ride. Then you had streetcars. In a lot of European cities, you had streetcars. We'd had them here, too. And that took the place of a car. But what happens, Asia, is that when the middle class becomes able to afford a car worldwide, that's the first thing they buy.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's China, India, any worldwide here in this country, Mexico, anywhere, they buy a car. In Tokyo, the congestion is insane.
Mm-hmm.
And you will sit for an hour on the Rainbow Bridge trying to get from Yokohama across to Chiba. And but people still buy the car. And they may spend $6,000 getting a driver's license. And it's very, very expensive, and they still buy a car. And the reason is that when you're in your car, you're in your private space. You can have your radio on. If people still smoke, they can smoke. They can be by themselves. And as the world gets more congested and cities are organized congestion, privacy becomes absolutely the thing that people tend to value
mm-hmm.
a lot. That's
mm-hmm.
one of the reasons.
Right, I see. I know that working on the project, you make a lot of preparation research and study new technologies, forecasts, and so on. So what news impressed you recently in the sphere of technology or science?
Making things. This three-dimensional duplication in a box.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. It's rapid fabrication of things, and you can make a lot of even. Eventually, you'll go into a store that sells, you know, smaller things like a toothbrush or a hair dryer or a product like a coffee maker or something.
Mm-hmm.
And the store will have, in the back of the store, there'll be this machine, maybe several of them,
mm-hmm.
and it'll be fed with powdered plastic or material. And you're at the counter and you say to the clerk, I would like to have this model of toothbrush in this color. You'll press a button and the software starts this machine going. In about 10 minutes, you have a brand new toothbrush that is not shipped there. It does not. It hasn't been kept in a warehouse. It's made on the spot.
So
this is going to change retail completely.
How is the company called which produces this type of machine?
There's several of them. But it's just starting as an industry. It originally started by the military to do closed volume valving systems.
Mm-hmm.
This is way back, you know, 20 some years ago. They wanted to, when you have an electronic burst, it paralyzes or fries electronic systems. So for fighter planes and bombers and so forth, they wanted something that would resist, that was not electronic, and they were working with fluid computers. And you need these intricate little switches, which are all closed shut in a volume. And because you could print these layer by layer by layer, you could make these elaborate little labyrinth interiors of this volume, which then became essentially a liquid computer. That's what started. Now they're thinking of making like artificial organs that can now scan live cells layer by layer and make a living organic component.
Isn't that scary?
It's a little bit scary right now.
To me, it sounds very scary. Like, I mean, just the pure idea that they can reproduce my hand or my leg. That sounds a bit scary.
Think about hearts. Think about kidneys.
And brain. My ideas.
And well, but if you can have spare organs being made with your DNA, then if anything goes wrong, they just put in a new one.
But doesn't it sound a bit unnatural? I mean, this thing does not exist in nature. I mean, this is some...
Well, you're duplicating nature. What happens generally with technology is that more and more we learn to duplicate what nature takes maybe millions of years to do, or thousands, or tens, or whatever. And we learn to do that faster because we understand how it happens in the first place. And nature uses time as the advantage. We use technology to figure out why something is happening down at the atomic and molecular level, and we duplicate it. So it's still natural because you can't make something out of something that doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. We're working with the same materials that nature has. We're just manipulating them at a faster pace and in different ways than nature does. And so in a strange way, they're still natural, but the process is being speeded up.
I see. Well, but still, it's a bit scary to me. Of course, I'm curious. I'm curious to see how it happens, how it's going
to Asia,
happen.
If you saw two oranges sitting on a table, one was made in about 6 hours, and the other one was made in a couple of months. They're both oranges.
But I would still prefer the one which was made during the couple of months.
I don't know why. They smell the same, taste the same, look the same, exactly the same.
I don't know. I'm just... I don't know. Subconsciously, I would still think if you tell me this orange was grown during a couple of months, I would subconsciously think that this orange is better than that one. It's more natural. That's what I would think, I would probably be mistaken.
Well, let's take the manufactured object, which is you have to make a lot of them to make money. That's no longer the case. You could make one each, completely different, these new little instant replication boxes. But let's say, as time goes on, it already has, we can make things by the tens of thousands, the same thing. I think handcrafted items will become very precious because they're not being made automatically by a machine.
Yes.
And it's the old Japanese theory of it's more valuable because it's old and people have used it, which goes back into the Edo period of Japan, but it's a switch in cultural realization or valuation.
Mm-hmm. Well, I understand. Of course, I understand what you're talking about. And even if we talk about books, the printed books, if you go to Moscow underground, you will see that the people are now using these electronic books, the tablets. They are all. But still, I prefer traditional printed books simply because it's the feeling, it's some kind of aesthetically more pleasing to read a printed book, a paper book.
Yeah, that's because you're sitting at home on your divan, or because the book is heavy. Books are heavy. The genius behind the electronic book is that you can have any book you want with you all the time.
Yes.
The trick is it takes a huge industry behind that to provide the content and the broadcast and the download technology so you can read it on a glowing sheet.
Mm-hmm.
That's the disadvantage. It has to have batteries. You have to charge it. And the industry to provide the content through that little tablet is huge. That's the disadvantage. A book has no batteries. You can carry it with you. You can make notes in the margins of the pages. And, you know, it's yours. It's a possession. So it's really different mentality.
Well, that's why I think the paper books, at least not in the nearest 10 years will be disappeared, although some people say, oh, in a couple of years we'll have no longer the paper, the printed books. I still think that
we will have them. Yes, they'll always persist as an artifact.
Right. So are there any new design projects which have impressed you recently? Or maybe new...
In terms of space science, the new telescope that's being made to replace the Hubble.
Mm-hmm.
Hubble is technologically, the Hubble has been repaired once because the mirrors were ground the wrong way. And it only lasts another 3 years or 4 years. There's a new one that will be launched, and we're looking further and further back in space-time. And, of course, the curious part of that is if we're looking back 100,000 light years or more, that means that light was coming towards us for 100,000 years, so we really don't know what's happening at all because we can't see. We're 100,000 years behind the fact of whatever happened. We won't know for another 100,000 years. That's the curious fact of the time distance, which I think is fascinating just for that reason. We don't know what's happening at all.
Mm-hmm. And among young designers, is there anyone that you like?
I really don't follow individuals that way. I follow what I see in magazines about car design. And the car design now is going through a phase because it's done by computer, and these people going to these design schools, and this includes Art Center, they use the computer modeling software mm-hmm. to make the car look the way it does. And I don't think they have a really firm grasp of how reflections happen on a polished car surface. Some of these cars are too small mm-hmm. to have all the activity in the morphology on the surface of the car. It's just too much is going on, and they look like they've been in an accident when they're brand new.
I see. So don't you think that the process of creation is also a bit impersonalized when the designers, the artists do everything over the computer with the help of the software? It seems so easy and so quick. Compared to the traditional pen and pencil?
Not really. You still have to know what you're doing. Mm-hmm. The computer doesn't do it all by itself. It has to be told in a very elaborate way. That's what the software does. But you still have to learn you have to have a sense of taste, you have to have a sense of shape, the idea quality has to be as high as it's ever been. You just now have a new tool, that's all. And mm-hmm. the tool will change. If we keep pursuing this EKG brain broadcast technology, I mean, now you can have an artificial arm or a leg, and your brain, you can think about moving it, and your brain transmits a signal, and the artificial leg moves just like it would if you had a real leg,
mm-hmm.
because your brain produces that same signal. That's amazing to me. And if you connect that up to an electronic image maker, you could make images appear on a screen just by thinking of them. I think that's fascinating. But that's a tool.
The computer does not have any kind of inspiration.
No. And so my favorite saying is, if you have $1 million computer and a bad idea, you end up with $1 million bad idea. So it's all tied together. You still have to know how to make a picture. Mm-hmm. And why it's a good picture or a bad picture. You have to know how to design something and feel about it and put your personal preference, your personal ideas into the finished object, and how it's made or how it's drawn or how it's prepared for manufacture. That's an extension of the idea.
So what I'm talking about ideas, if you could tell me about the process of a new idea, what inspires you? And can you give an example of your inspiration based on one of your works, if possible? Does it just jump into your head and then you try to...
Sometimes it does, but you first have to have a very accurate idea of why you're doing something. I'm not very fond of what they call fine art, really.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it's like a spoiled child putting marks on a wall sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to have a very... very definite idea of why you're doing something, why you want it to look a certain way, whether it's a car or a painting or a toothbrush. And then you start to think about ways of making it look different than the last one you saw. You know, that's your creative idea, because you're being paid for thinking of something different that still reminds of the same kind of thing. Otherwise, you can't get rid of it commercially, because people don't know what it is. Simple as that.
And
so you think up some really sort of crazy ways or variations. That's your first step, because if you don't start out crazy and then pull back, you've cheated the final process because you started too soon to the solution. You don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You have to start far back, absolutely crazy, and then you review your first round of ideas as a sort of an analytical, and the trick is to pretend that you're three different people. You have to know what the outside boundaries are. I mean, you're doing a toothbrush, you're not doing a new hat. But inside of that foggy, sort of hazy back perimeter, then the second person looks at what the first person did and says, well, that looks more, you know, like I thought it should look. And then the third person is the client representative.
Mm-hmm.
And then you tie it down to maybe you have to make drawings or manufacturing CAD drawings or something. But you really have to do those three steps to make it successful at the end.
Mm-hmm. And what
now,
do you
if you're making a boutique object that doesn't have to look, actually it doesn't have to do anything other than just looking clever, that's not really what we're talking about. That becomes into the area of gallery art objects, and that's completely different from product.
Mm-hmm. So what do you do when you have to prepare a project and the ideas don't come?
Oh, you can go to the museum, or you can walk around outside and look at plants, or just read something. You have to your brain. If you train your brain properly, your brain can do the work for you. That's what it's supposed to be there. That's what it's there for. And if you overload it with anxiety,
mm-hmm.
or too much pressure, you sort of freeze up and you can't think properly. You get scared, and that's poison to creative thinking.
Mm-hmm. I understand. Some fans of yours have asked this question. You've been self-employed for many years. How do you plan your day and how to develop self-discipline?
Well, self-discipline you just have to have.
So it's not possible to develop it.
Well, you can develop it if you're frightened enough about not making any more money, I suppose. But you have to discipline is sort of a trait of some people, and some people it's not. That's why you have
all these management books, time management books. They're all worthless if you don't have it.
Well, a lot of them, if you read them, Asia, a lot of them are just. If you think about what they're saying, you're thinking, "Well, that's very sensible. I mean, why did I buy this book to find that out? I should have known that anyway." And I think a lot of them are making money, not dishonestly, but they're sort of silly.
I've never bought this book.
I go to a lot of conferences, and I've been on judging panels, and there are people who are professional conference speaker people, and mostly they're just saying what they said at the last conference, and maybe they changed their vocabulary a little bit, and I think it's wonderful to listen to them because they're so predictable.
Yeah, well, it's just in fashion, it's just popular to read such books. So how do you plan your day? What time do you wake up and... every day different, or it has...
Every day is probably different. That we get emails, the phone rings, we're off on a new adventure, mm-hmm. and it happens. Once you have visibility to our level worldwide, you just literally do not know what's going to happen next.
Mm-hmm.
And you have projects in progress, which we do, and you work around that, and we'd like to have this by next week, and you say, well, I'm terribly sorry, but you can't have it until a month from now, and then they hang up and you never hear from them again. So you have to have, if you have work to do, that runs your day because you've got to get it done by some sort of a planned, mutually agreed deadline, otherwise you're not in business.
Mm-hmm.
But I get up about, I go to the gymnasium 3 days a week, so I get up at 6:30, 6:45. I'm at the gymnasium by 8 and exercise for an hour,
mm-hmm.
and then come back and start the working day here at home with my partner, Roger.
Mm-hmm. So you are a morning person rather than a night person.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm 10 o'clock, I'm in bed. I don't like to stay up too late. I have. If there's a good movie on, we'll download it from Netflix. And if there's a really good movie that holds my attention, then we'll stay up later. But most often, 10 o'clock is about the time that you think, oh, I think I'll go to bed.
Okay. That's nice. I'm a night person, but
yeah.
I've always dreamt of becoming a morning person.
Well, mainly because of my age. You know, when I was in my 30s, I'd be out at the bars drinking until 2 in the morning and then work all day the next day. Didn't bother me at all. And I just,
so you didn't have a hangover at that time?
No, and I can't do that anymore.
Okay, so some more questions from your fans. What is your first recollection from your childhood?
My first recollection?
Yeah, your first memory when you were a child.
Well, the house we lived in St. Paul, Minnesota, where I was born. I probably was about, I don't know, 2.5 or 3. I remember how our house sat up above the sidewalk on a raised lawn. There was about 7 steps up to the lawn level from the sidewalk. My father was a Baptist minister, and the house we lived in was right north of the church, because that's very common to have the minister or the priest or the bishop or whatever live next to the church. And so we lived in this little house,
mm-hmm.
and I remember sort of how it sat on the lawn. We had a little pool in the back, and I vaguely remember how that house looked.
Mm-hmm. So you were about 2.5 at that time.
Yes, and then we moved to a little town called Canton, South Dakota, which is on the border of Iowa. It's on the southeastern border of Iowa. And I remember that house quite accurately. I had an upstairs room on the front of the house. It's sort of an arched style window, and I could look out to the street. And I just would sit up there and draw all day long. Just draw, draw, draw.
Right. So that was your favorite thing. Drawing was your favorite activity
always.
You were a child.
Yes, yes, constantly.
Great. So, and what about now? What tools do you use when you create your projects? Do you still prefer pen and pencil or some computer?
Pen and ink. Pen and ink on 8.5 by 11, I forget what the A series, is it A4 or A2 or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
What's a typewriter size, metric sheet size?
A4,
yeah. With just pen and paper, pen and ink, I buy these little Pilot disposable ink pens and do sketches, because ideas have no scale until you assign a scale to them.
Mm-hmm.
I've worked on cruise ships, which are 800, 900 feet long, and I start the same way on a sheet of paper that size, because you're after the idea remembrance, not the fact that it's a real drawing, manufacturing drawing. So you draw, and then I'll probably scan those in as
mm-hmm.
a computer record. And then I'll blow them up. I have a big Epson printer, and I'll blow them up and make a line drawing and a trace and shade those with felt-tip markers, a grayscale felt-tip markers,
mm-hmm.
and scan that in and colorize it, add typography, and then if it's a movie, that goes to the director for approval or to
mm-hmm.
the client if it's not a movie. And that works really very well. So I'm using an iMac, which is a big screen computer.
Mm-hmm.
I have a small Epson printer, an RX. I have a big Epson printer, Pro 3880. And I have a big Epson a scanner, a flatbed scanner. And then I have a 17-inch Apple laptop, which I use at my desk.
And no iPad?
Small... No, I don't really need one. I have a small computer, which is 13-inch, that I take on trips. Because when I do my shows, all I need is something to play back to the local computer system. I don't need a really full-function computer.
Mm-hmm.
So I bought, and it's lighter, too. A 17-inch Macintosh laptop is as heavy as a piece of glass the same size, so it's very heavy.
So what do you think about this old cloud thing when you can store everything you have?
I don't want to do that. And the reason is because the government has access to that. The providers have to have their records open to the government on demand. And I don't want my stuff on the cloud, because I don't have that much stuff, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can buy a 3-terabyte drive for like $200. Why would I have all my stuff stored on the cloud? The reason that people have it on the cloud is that they're moving around with their iPhones or smartphones or Blackberries,
right.
and they can download all the time without having to be home. That's the reason.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't work that way. We're home.
I understand.
And I don't need to access information when I'm traveling to that extent, because my business does not depend on me being somewhere other than home, unless we're doing a show, and that doesn't have anything to do with design or why we're there. So I don't need the cloud as a information storage alternative at all.
I see.
Plus the security concerns.
Coming back to the transportation design, what should the students of the transportation design pay attention to?
They should pay attention to shape trends. They should periodically stroll through a shopping mall, see what people are buying, what colors look more prominent. They should read comments in newspapers or online about what people think about their lives. Because eventually they're making transportation ideas which have to fit into how people actually use them. And if you have if you guess wrong, it's a very expensive mistake.
Right. So how to guess right? To always
luck. You have to be lucky. You have to
right.
be lucky.
So it's
some
just...
people have a knack though. You know, some people, consultants, they're successful because they've been lucky. Their guesses have been right most of the time, but it's luck. It's because you figure the world's population, the billions of people, and then you shrink that down to the billions of people that actually buy something. Now we're not talking about rural China or Mongolia. We're talking about the concentrated semi or full developed countries, and these decisions are being made by the second all the time. And you can't really plan how to exactly match that ever, but you can match an average. And so these global companies that make cars, they make cars for the whole world, and they follow trends and figure out that gasoline prices, fuel worldwide, where they're going to sell the car, and what the size, preferred size is, and that's how they make their final decision.
I see. So you've been lucky, because you've
I've
guessed
lucky,
most
yes.
of the time.
I've been lucky most of the time, yes. Yes, I've car designs I did for the U.S. Steelbooks back in the 60s, and they still look good. They look just as good as a Murcielago or a Lamborghini or anything else in that exotic car category because I was lucky.
That's great. What exactly did you do for Star Trek and for which episode?
Star Trek the motion picture, the first motion picture. I did the V'ger entity, which was the end of the film. This is the entity that's threatening the world with destruction, and it's this big, huge thing with an opening at the front. It was actually a restrike of Roddenberry's, one of his early TV series, or TV episodes. But it was made into a movie Robert Wise directed. He's dead now. I worked with John Dykstra and his special effects facility. He's done other things since then. But, no, that was my first movie. And then after that, the first movie I worked on from pre-production to theatrical release was Blade Runner and then Tron. So my first time out on a full movie became the most famous one. Ridley Scott is a genius. He really is. He's focused. And he made that picture, Blade Runner, under very severe financial problems or restrictions.
I've read about Blade Runner.
Yeah. You have to give him enormous credit for what he pulled off, what he did under those constrictions. And then Tron, Steve Lisberger at Disney. Disney was going through a very critical time in its corporate history. It was almost sold off in separate entities, and it stayed together. But Tron would never have been made if Disney would have had a traditional full management in force. And then it was 2010, Aliens with Jim Cameron, and then Short Circuit with John Badham, and, you know, so then it goes on and on.
That's great. Well, Mr. Sid, I would like to thank you for this wonderful interview. Once again, it's been an honor for me to talk to you.
Well, we'll keep in touch. You know, we do travel, and what we're trying to do right now is to set up, we have a traveling show called Progressions, and you probably have seen it on our website.
Yeah.
It's 50 pieces of gouache art, and gouache is not used anymore, really, at this technical illustration level. It just is not. A lot of the kids use Wacom tablets or Cintiq. And So this could be the last large collection on tour of that in that medium, at that mm-hmm. level of scale. And we're trying to get together a European tour. We have a very interesting fellow in Paris who has a gallery on the Champs-Élysées. And if it goes to Europe at all, you'd like to have it go to several places, because when it goes out of this country, you have letters of carnet, which influences the custom process and all mm-hmm. that for going in and out of the country. And you'd like to have different places for it to go so that it's worthwhile doing all that paperwork and the transportation and so forth. So
Moscow will welcome you, I'm sure, or St. Petersburg.
Maybe you'll have a show in Moscow.
Yeah. Or in St. Petersburg.
In St. Petersburg, yes.
Yeah,
now, that's where the Hermitage.
Yeah, the Hermitage is in St. Petersburg, and I'm from St. Petersburg. So,
uh-huh.
just for your information.
Yeah. Well, listen, take care of yourself and say hello to all our fans.
Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate that, and have a wonderful day. All right. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Lots of books and discussions at www.lingvistov.ru.